Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. On a snowy day here in Metro Atlanta and across much of the southwest section of our state, many people are at home today, not able to get to work in parts of the state. So wherever you are, we hope you're near enough to a radio to listen to Political Rewind today. We're joined today by Teresa Tomlinson, the mayor of Columbus, Georgia, the Democratic mayor of Columbus, Georgia, who visits with us now on a monthly basis. I'm really glad that we have a regular schedule with you,
yeah,
Mayor.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, just it's a nonpartisan mayor who happens to be a Democrat.
Okay.
I like that.
It is a nonpartisan position, and people in Columbus take it really seriously.
Okay, so, thank you for that correction.
Yeah.
Eric Tannenblatt, you just heard him briefly. He, of course, is a Republican operative. He is one of the best-known bundlers, fundraisers for Republican candidates from president all the way down to some local races. I've been harassing Eric before the show about whether the man who he worked very hard for back in the presidential election of 2012, Mitt Romney, is getting set to run for Senate in Utah, and you won't tell me.
No, I hope he does. He'd be a great senator.
All right. Mayor Tomlinson, before we get started on the political aspect of the show, there are a lot of people who are listening to the show down your way. What are the conditions like down there?
You better be at home, and you better stay at home. We've got 63 closed roads at our last count. It's just not conditions that people need to be out in, and so we've asked everybody to stay home. We've closed the city government. Of course, our schools are closed, and we expect at least a delayed opening tomorrow. So stay at home, please.
And Eric, you had to drive in from a little bit. You're outside. Are you outside or inside?
No, I'm inside the city in the Buckhead area.
Okay, but you didn't find the roads easily passable, did you?
Well, the highways were fine. The on and off ramps were still slippery, and the side streets were really slippery.
All right. Well, Nathan Deal, we're in budget week over at the state capitol, Nathan Deal, the governor, he shut down the government today, and they've already announced from the governor's office that they're going to keep state employees at home tomorrow as well. So this is turning out to be a major snow event, which I think caught a lot of people by surprise.
I have to say it certainly did. I mean, we knew it was coming, just didn't know it would have quite this impact. So
I think the temperatures had a lot to do with
that.
And I think that's probably, everything's melted today is going to freeze over tonight.
Yeah, exactly. We're also joined on the phone by Greg Bluestein, who, Greg, you're at home with the little ones, aren't you?
I am. Every snow event, my wife usually ends up sleeping at the hospital where she works, and so I usually have the kids, or grandmas have the kids, but we've been leaning on grandmas a lot lately, so today I've got the kids.
All right.
They're upstairs happily playing.
Well, stay with us for a while on the phone, because we are going to start by talking about the story that is getting attention nationally, and that certainly becomes a major news story for us here in Georgia, and that's David Perdue, Georgia's junior senator, who has adamantly defended for really the better part of the last week the president in regard to the question of whether he made a vulgar, obscene comment about people who live in third world countries, not necessarily even third world countries, who live in African countries, some African countries, and in Haiti. While almost everybody who's been involved in the meeting at which this comment was supposed to have been made have said, yes, the president did say S-hole or S-house one way or the other, Perdue and Tom Cotton have stuck together and insisted that it's not true. Let's just listen briefly to Senator Perdue on Sunday talking with George Stephanopoulos.
I'm not clear on exactly what you're saying happened in this meeting. You say it was a gross misrepresentation. Senator Durbin has been very clear. Senator Graham has told others that the reports were basically accurate. Are you saying the president did not use the word that has been so widely reported?
I'm telling you he did not use that word, George, and I'm telling you it's a gross misrepresentation. How many times do you want me to say that?
All right. Greg Bluestein, let me start with you on this, because you've been reporting on this story ever since it happened. What's the latest on this, and where is this all heading?
Yeah, so on Friday, we have Senator Perdue's office saying he does not recall what was said in that closed-door meeting that only a handful of people were at. And then on Sunday, we just heard, that's what he said on Sunday, which was that flat out Donald Trump had not used the word asshole. So that has led to some questions about why his story has been shifting. I got a call from his office this morning, basically trying to push back on the on reporting that his story is shifting, saying that really if their contention is that his story is not shifting at all, that what he said on Friday when he did not recall what Donald Trump said is the same as what he said on Sunday, where he said Donald Trump flat out didn't say that. Now I pushed back on that as well, and I said, hey, we're reporting what we're reporting. But there's also, of course, this is going far beyond us. There's a national firestorm over these comments. There's Washington Post columnists calling for David Perdue to resign. There was a protest yesterday outside his office from protest demonstrators urging him to resign. And there's several candidates, would-be candidates for his office who are making light of this, or not making light of it, but highlighting these comments as something that he might be reminded of in 2020.
Teresa, I guess the question we need to ask, and I'll start with you, is what could be, okay, almost everyone acknowledges that a vulgarity was expressed by the president, and yet Perdue sticks to his guns.
Yeah.
What, you're a political thinker. What would be the advantage to him of doing this?
Well, I have to say, to cite Jim Galloway, of course, Greg's colleague over at the AJC, I think he hit the nail on the head. When he first came out and said he didn't recall hearing such a thing, it was, as Jim says, a reaction to a political problem. He conferred, of course, with Senator Cotton about it, who was his co-sponsor on the Reyes bill, which is the immigration bill to reduce immigration to the United States by 50% and some other adjustments. And so that was the political problem, because you cannot have this sort of politically, you can't have this racial motivation to your legislation, expect it to pass. Then, of course, Jim points out that he most probably got some legal counsel between then and the evolution of the story, and that was that if the words were uttered, should Reyes pass, it will likely be thrown out in court, just as the Muslim ban has been, because you cannot have a racial motivation for legislation related to immigration. And so I think that he hit the nail on the head. The Muslim ban has had these same problems. They've used President Trump's tweets and his statements at rallies and things of that nature to show that it was definitely racially, religiously motivated. And, of course, that's discriminatory and violative of the law.
Eric, I want to be careful about something here. There's been an awful lot of time consumed by everybody in the media about the use of that vulgarity. Did he say asshole? Did he say asshouse? And it strikes me that that's the wrong focus. The real question here is, whatever word was used, this seemed to be the president of the United States making an incredibly caustic, derogatory, some people think racist remark about countries around the world. The word itself strikes me as not being the most important aspect of this.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's not as if the president hasn't said inflammatory things, you know, over the course of his tenure, not just in office, but even as a candidate and before that. I think that also, you know, focusing so much on the word and what word was actually used is getting away from what the real issue was. I mean, you had Senator Durbin and Senator Graham coming to the White House after the meeting earlier in the week saying we've reached a compromise, thinking the president was going to be supportive of the compromise. And there are other forces that are not in agreement. And I think what happened was when those two senators arrived, whether it was Senator Perdue and Senator Cotton and Congressman Goodlatte and others that were in the room, it became a little bit of a heated, contentious conversation,
yeah,
and words were said.
Greg, to amplify Eric's comments, the scenario we've been all told about in terms of what happened in that meeting is that we had two senators – Republican and Democrat poised to make a deal, with Trump apparently being in favor of a deal. And then Stephen Miller, who is an advisor to the president, and virulently anti-immigration from his past record, he apparently was very nervous that the president might go ahead and enter a deal. And he invited these very conservative members of Congress, like Perdue, like Cotton, like Goodlatte, to come in to be sure that the president held firm. Right, Greg?
Yes, and also with his chief of staff also there watching on. And from what we've heard, and this is from the mouth of Dick Durbin, who was in the room, when the president actually, you know, apparently made that vulgar comment, he was challenged by Senator Lindsey Graham, who said that doesn't live up to the American ideals, American dreams. It puts Lindsey Graham in an interesting, awkward position, too. Lindsey Graham has not confirmed whether or not Trump said those words in the interest of trying to keep his deal alive. But in the same frame, he's also said that his memory has not evolved. He knows what was said and
we're in this awful situation where we've got essentially senators and representatives calling each other, if not in word, certainly by inference, liars. Here's what Dick Durbin said most recently about the meeting.
Make no mistake, I know exactly what he said. And after he said it, my colleague, Senator Graham, who was sitting next to him, answered him directly, using the same word and telling the story of his family, which he said, "My family came, Mr. President, from one of those S-hole countries with no skills and no resources, and they just want to be part of what we call America. And they made a life and made a business, and I'm here today."
Teresa Tomlinson, yeah. It's already been referred to on the show, but all of this takes place with a looming deadline Friday for a spending bill that has to pass. There's now talk they're going to try to kick the can down the road another month, possibly, but maybe not. The whole idea has been to try to get on the same page in terms of some compromise on extending DACA, deferred action for children arrivals, and then also additional security, some piece of the wall or other. And now that's all been thrown up into the air, and it's not even what we're focused on anymore.
Right. We're firmly caught up in the politics, when really, if we would keep our eye on the fact that there's some very troubling policy that was been revealed, again, the racial motivation behind some of these policies. I think, you know, those who support the president often tout that he says what he thinks. And then you heard a lot of people immediately in the aftermath of these statements say, well, he's just saying what everybody thinks. Well, now that's interesting. And vulgarity aside, really another part of the stunning statement that nobody seems to disagree with at all is that he compared the favored status of Norwegians, know, a country that's over 90% Caucasian and certainly has a Scandinavian purity. And so those folks are apparently more favored in his mind. And so you're going to have a real problem here. I think a shock of the conscience among Republicans as they begin talking about immigration, talking about DACA, and how we feel about black and brown people coming to this country.
Yeah,
it's troubling.
Eric, I think Teresa just really made a point that I wanted to ask you about. This does it not, once again, cause Republicans like yourself to do some soul searching about where you all stand in the framework of a Trump presidency? Or is that, do you think, not a correct way of expressing this?
No, I mean, there's clearly a concern, and you're seeing that in the polls of, you know, there was just a poll that came out this past weekend in the Atlanta Constitution that showed that, you know, the president has lost support among independents and more moderate Republicans. The interesting thing, though, is he seems to still be holding onto his base, and that's because I think people, Republicans, want us to have a Republican president, you know, because of, you know, policy that can be implemented that we haven't had a chance to implement. But I think what we saw with this immigration and what we're still seeing with this immigration debate is that immigration is an issue that has been a challenge for not just this president, but for the past two presidents, and maybe even before that. I remember George W. Bush trying to get immigration reform legislation passed, and he had to fight his own party in doing so. President Obama had Democratic control of the House and the Senate, and he didn't even advance immigration legislation then. So this is a issue where you have people that have very strong opinions. It's a diverse issue. The DACA issue is obviously something that's very timely right now because it deals with a segment of the population that is feeling very insecure right now. But it's a challenging issue. And Donald Trump is new to politics. Yes, he's been president for a year, but this is a guy who's been a deal maker and a businessman, and it's very different than politics. And he's seeing firsthand that this is not just making a business deal.
Hey, Greg, let me play you a soundbite from, of all people, Stephen Colbert the other night. And I'm using it to make a point about how Senator Perdue has put himself smack dab in the middle of this thing and perhaps made himself a target in a way that is not advantageous to what he hopes to accomplish in the Senate. Let's listen to this brief moment from Colbert.
So yesterday, you can't remember whether it happened, then suddenly you have a vivid memory of it never happening. I guess that's, you know, fairly common, like how at first I couldn't remember if Senator Perdue had a spine, then I had a vivid memory of him never having one.
So, Greg, that is really harsh. But what Perdue has put himself right in the middle of this thing, and I guess the fallout will be what it is.
Yeah, and he's sort of, to critics of Trump, he's become the caricature of a Trump loyalist who would do anything to stay in the president's good graces. Even if that means to them changing a story about what happened in a closed door meeting. And this is something that those of us who have covered David Perdue from the get-go, I mean, he was one of the first senators to support Donald Trump. He has always cast himself as sort of a key ally to Donald Trump. And he's one of his biggest initiatives is this sort of overhauling the immigration process, the legal immigration process. And this is the center of everything he's doing in Washington. And I think that that plays into this, too. I mean, he can't afford to have the president, turn his back on some of his initiatives, including this one.
And if I could say, Bill, it really lays bare what many critics had suspected, that maybe this raise immigration bill was putting forward purported merit-based immigration as a mask for some real racially troubling agendas.
Well, now,
because let me say, they say, well, this is just like Canada. No, sir, it's not. In Canada, they're actually raising the number of family visas and immigrants they allow to come in. They're actually seeking to have multiculturalism through allowing refugees at a much higher rate than we do. I mean, they have one-tenth of the population we do, and yet they let in 60% of the refugees that we do.
So it does strike me, Eric, that this is the price that maybe Perdue pays for being so supportive the president in this moment. Theresa Tomlinson sees the motivations, racial motivations, to what Cotton and Perdue wanted to do with their bill, largely because they've stuck it out with Trump. And yet it's hard for us to really ascertain whether that was in their hearts or not. They're not the first ones who made these derogatory remarks.
Well, I could tell you, I know David Perdue and have known him for 15 plus years. I know Tom Cotton as well, not as long. And I could tell you that is not in their hearts. And I could speak, from what I've seen with David Perdue mm-hmm. over the years. I think David Perdue is up in Washington because he wants to get things done. He wants to, do things that he thinks Washington has not been effective in doing in the past. My guess is when he made the comment on Friday that he didn't recall the president saying that, I think he probably didn't. I think he probably was caught up in the whole conversation where he was there to defend his position and his bill that he and Tom Cotton worked on. But, Stephen Colbert and the national media can try and, paint David Perdue any way they want. But the people that elected David Perdue are the people here in Georgia. And I think the people here in Georgia who know him best know where he is and what's inside his heart.
Well, telling an untruth or changing a story, evolving a story that brings into question your basic credibility is a basic human tell of fear. And I think the potential exposing of this discussion, of this language, of the comparison between Nordic immigrants and those from black, predominantly black countries, was so exposing it ignited fear in the hearts and minds of the two senators that were proposing this legislation that perhaps it had been exposed. And so if this isn't it, then they need to stop. If that's not the case, they should find it repugnant. They should stop enabling the president in his discussion and understanding of what they're trying to achieve here and come out like statesmen, as did Johnny Isaacson. Lindsey Graham, to me, this isn't a partisan thing. We're seeing great leadership by some few Republican senators.
All right, Greg, I know we've got to let you go because I think you've locked your little children in a closet so they wouldn't disturb you, and we don't want them to have to stay there too long. Is this, look, it's 2018. The 2020 election cycle is still a long way off, but is this... Can you imagine, it's hard to say what issues will stay around and will be sticky between now and, say, 2020, but it strikes me that this is one that may have staying power so that when Perdue comes up for re-election, it will be fodder used against him. What do you think?
I think so. I think Democrats will use this as a part of a package to kind of portray him as a sort of blindly loyal to the president. It won't just be this. There will be some other instances
sure.
that will probably package together. But I think that will be part of any Democratic contender's case that they will be an independent voice and that David Perdue is lockstep with the president.
All right, Greg Bluestein, we appreciate your taking a little time. Please stay dry and warm and safe up there with your girls. Thanks for joining us, Greg.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Eric Tannenblatt. Eric, I apologize. In addition to talking about your credentials as a Republican, I always think we should point out you're the head of the government affairs practice for the world's largest law firm, Dentons.
Well, thanks for the commercial. Largest in leading.
Largest in leading. Thank you very much. I'll try to keep that on my notes for next time. And the mayor of Columbus, Teresa Tomlinson, who's frantically checking to see whether I-85 is clear enough for her to be able to get back home
exactly
to be
right.
with her people.
That's right. That's right.
tonight. Yep. In the middle of all of this Sturm und Drang that comes out of the White House, yesterday, the director of Homeland Security, Kristen Nielsen, was on the Hill. She, of course, is a protege of the chief of staff, President Trump's chief of staff, John Kelly. And to no one's great surprise, she really got hammered, drilled, primarily by Democrats, but a few Republicans as well, because she was in that meeting last week in which this profanity was alleged to have been uttered. Let's listen to a little of the back and forth. You're going to hear Dick Durbin questioning her.
You said on Fox News that the president used strong language. What was that strong language?
Let's see. It's strong language. There was apologies. I don't remember specific word. What I was struck with, frankly, as I'm sure you were as well, was just the general profanity that was used in the room by almost everyone.
Did you hear me use profanity?
No, sir. Neither did I.
Did you hear Senator Graham use profanity?
I did hear tough language from Senator Graham. Yes, sir.
What did he say?
He used tough language, and to underscore a point, I think he was using some strong language.
Do you recall that the strong language he used repeated exactly what the president had said prior to that?
I remember specific cuss words being used by a variety of members.
And in defense of Senator Graham, his strong words repeated exactly the words used by the president, which you cannot remember.
Eric, this seems to be a pattern that many people have noted, which is that people who go to work for President Trump find themselves struggling mightily to be careful in whether they say anything at all that might impugn in any way the president, being terribly concerned about whether they contradict to some extent what the president is feeling, is thinking, is talking about. And there are people, and Republicans, I think it's fair to say, as well as Democrats, who feel like this is a reason that people don't really want to go to work for the Trump administration. They're put in very awkward positions, as Nielsen appears to have been yesterday.
Yeah, I agree. I felt for her. I mean, she was, you know, being questioned by senators under oath, and, you know, that's a fine line. Sometimes I feel, you know, like when I'm on, you know, Political Rewind and get asked a hard question that I don't want to answer. But, you know, look, I think she did the best that she could in an awkward situation.
Teresa Tomlinson, let me, before I get your reaction, of all the people who were quizzing Nielsen yesterday, perhaps the one who got the most heated and emotional was Senator Cory Booker, who, by the way, may very well be a Democratic candidate for president. We don't want to forget that's part of the equation.
The commander-in-chief, in an Oval Office meeting, referring to people from African countries and Haitians with the most vile and vulgar language. That language festers. When ignorance and bigotry is allied with power, it is a dangerous force in our country. Your silence and your amnesia is complicity. I hurt. When Dick Durbin called me, I had tears of rage when I heard about this experience in that meeting. You don't remember. You can't remember the words of your commander-in-chief. I find that unacceptable.
Teresa Tomlinson.
Yeah, well, it strains credibility, certainly, and she is the head of the Department of Homeland Security, which, frankly, if she can't remember a meeting that she had in the Oval Office with senators, a congressman, and the president of the United States, I'm not sure she should be holding this job. And so I think if she cannot credibly testify before the Senate that her role in that particular position has been called into question. But let me just say this, and I say this without hopefully more pragmatism than sanctimony. Just tell the truth and then deal with it. You know, it's not always easy, but it's easier than perpetuating the lie.
She was.
By the way, let me just say, her name has both her first and her last name still have the traditional Nordic spellings,
yeah, well,
and she has no idea that Norway is predominantly white.
I was just going to refer to that. We didn't play that portion of the Q&A with the testimony that she gave yesterday. She was asked why Trump talked about preferring Norwegians to, say, Haitians or some Africans. And she was puzzled. She claimed that it didn't occur to her. She didn't realize that Norway was a mostly white country. Eric, that's again one of those moments. Is just,
I know, but you know what? This is there's a lot of politics here too. I mean, we can't lose sight of that. I mean, she was testifying for another purpose. She wasn't there to testify on this meeting, and the Democrats are using this issue, regardless of where you come down on it and what the president said or not. They're grandstanding and using it as a political issue. I think Cory Booker is one of the most articulate orators, but I got to believe that was prepared. He knew exactly what he was going to do before that hearing and say exactly what he was going to say. And I'm sure Dick Durbin said the same thing. And you're praising Lindsey Graham for, you know, his, what he has said after the meeting. If you notice, he's not out there attacking the president. And so if the president said something inappropriate, Lindsey Graham made it known that this was his recollection of what the president said, but he's not grandstanding. And that's what I think the Democrats are doing. And I think they're doing the actual opposite of what they're trying to preach that we need to stop doing.
Let's listen to what Lindsey Graham said, and then I'll give you a chance to respond, Teresa.
So Tuesday, we had a president that I was proud to golf with, call my friend, who understood immigration had to be bipartisan. You had to have border security. It's essential you have border security with a wall, but he also understood the idea that we had to do it with compassion. Now, I don't know where that guy went, I want him back. This has turned into a S show, and we need to get back to being a great country.
Teresa, Eric Tanenblatt makes a point that deserves your opportunity to respond to, but it does strike me that as we watch everything unfold on Capitol Hill, in our dialogue around the country today, everything has become completely partisanly political. It's hard to come to an essential truth anymore, even a moral or ethical truth. Yes,
well,
or no?
I guess I'm struggling with this because people find this morally repugnant regardless of their party. You had Johnny Isaacson demand an apology to mankind. You have Lindsey Graham, I think, being morally outraged by this, and they are in the other party. And I would like to think there's more. And so, so I frankly, I'm struggling a little bit with the partisanship angle. I think we need to step back a minute and say we find racism to be morally repugnant. It's contrary to the basic foundations of our country. We've decided all men are created equal, and we're going to live by that creed. And so now we've got some folks in very high places who are struggling with it, and we need to admit it. We need to stop enabling them, and we also need to recognize that immigration is a very good thing. Let's take the sanctimony off for just a minute and just say it is an economically necessary competitive thing for this country. We have a negative worker replacement rate in this country. We cannot maintain our competitiveness as a world economic power unless we start increasing our population. Canada, that the Republicans like to talk so much about, are doing this and reaping the benefit because they have, frankly, a liberal immigration policy where they're taking in more refugees per capita than we are. They're taking in more family-based people than we are. You know, and these are the things we're trying to reverse, and now it's been exposed that that is, as many people thought, racially based.
Look, I don't disagree with a lot of what you said. There are elements I disagree with, but my big issue, and to Bill's point, is that we have got to stop turning all of this stuff into partisan bickering and solve problems. And I think we do have a number of lawmakers that are committed to solving problems, but it just seems like anytime there's an opportunity to pick a fight, that's what we...
Well, Eric, how I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if you don't mind, let me ask you about that. How does a Cory Booker express moral outrage in a way that leads you to believe he's speaking from his heart, not from his wearing the Democratic hat?
Well, he doesn't. He could make a statement, but what he was doing was, I mean, pounding the table and beating up on the Homeland Security director. I mean, she didn't do anything wrong. She just happened to be in the meeting where there was a comment that the president made that we're trying to figure out exactly what it was he said or what he didn't say. And I just think that we need to tone down the rhetoric and stop just immediately getting into our partisan corners.
So this I'm sorry, did you want to finish?
Well, I was going to say, and do what Lindsey Graham and Johnny Isaacson and Dick Durbin are trying to do and bring people together, but not just, automatically just revert to partisan bickering.
So let me just say, for our brothers and sisters of color that we live in community with here, they become quite fearful when they hear people in the highest echelons of this country saying such things. And so if our elected representatives do not express moral outrage, then, and frankly, and I'm just being serious about the construct of government here, then you threaten civic order. So our representatives have to say, I will not tolerate that. We are a community of mankind, of one multicultural America. And they have to hear that from the leaders, or they think they have to take it into their own hands.
I agree. And that's what Johnny Isaacson did. And that's what Lindsey Graham did. I guess where I take exception is the partisan lever, using issues like this as a platform to get into partisan politics.
All right.
Too many people are enabling this president. Too many Republicans are enabling this president.
Yeah,
they need to stop.
I suspect that, Eric, you wouldn't disagree with that, by the way. All right. Let me, Eric, so again, let's go back to it real quickly. The The concern now is, as of Friday night, we're out of money. I mean, we don't have any more power to spend money, and the government could shut down. Again, there's been some talk today, and I have to acknowledge that I have not been up on it. You may be more up on it hour to hour than I am, about trying to get a continuing resolution of 1 month. If that doesn't happen, if they shut the government down, who's going to get the blame?
Well, what they are planning on doing, or at least the latest plan I heard, was that they were going to put forth a continuing resolution where they were also going to extend the children's health insurance program for 6 years. There's been some
which
initial,
is a sweetener for the Democrats,
right, because,
who are very upset if DACA isn't part of
correct.
This fix. Go
and,
ahead.
And the head of the Freedom Caucus has said that he does not believe that they can pass this without Democratic votes, which is why you have that sweetener added.
Yeah.
Now, whether the Democrats are going to lock down and say, unless DACA is included, we're not going to vote for this. But to your question about the government shutdown, I think it's just going to, I think there's going to be blame across the board.
Yeah.
I mean, you could say that whoever the president is in power or with a party in power gets the blame. You know, Bill Clinton shut the government down when Newt Gingrich was the Speaker of the House. There's plenty. Yeah, there's plenty of blame to go around. As you saw back then, and I think that people are just going to blame Washington.
All right, I got to give you a quick update, and then I'm going to let you respond. Tom Faust is monitoring news, and the breaking story is that Lindsey Graham has just said he does not support a short-term spending bill. He is against kicking the can down the road.
Yeah, the polls
he
are
says
showing.
Eventually, what he said was eventually you've got to say no. Go
yeah,
ahead.
The polls show that Republicans are going to be squarely based blamed for this, but that shouldn't be the point. The point is we've sent you to Washington D.C. to run the government, and I'm sorry, Eric, I don't normally interrupt. I just the American people blamed Newt Gingrich for shutting down the government under Bill Clinton's during Bill Clinton's presidency, and that will happen again. So why don't we stop worrying about how it polls and start running the government? I think you have a situation where this particular group of Republicans have a lot of trouble. They've got all branches of the government here. I mean, they've got the legislative and the executive branch, and yet they cannot even get a continuing resolution through. And so I think they need to start working on some real compromises, as was presented by this gang of eight that came forward, and get it done. The American people are insisting upon it.
It's easier said than done.
Well,
because there's factions within the Republican Party, there's factions within the Democratic Party, and we apparently don't have the leaders up there to bring the necessary people together. I'm hoping that something can happen so that we can move the process forward.
Yeah, it's always easier said than done. There's no
right.
doubt about
well,
that. But we had something here, even though I personally don't like every aspect of it. We had something that was being proposed to the president that he said that if it was passed, he would sign.
Okay, but look, you cannot take politics out of politics. So who wins and who loses, I think, in a way, what everybody gets a hit. If you're Claire McCaskill and you have to run as a Democrat for re-election in a state that went for Trump, you're probably feeling today like you're going to get blamed by your voters in Missouri, or the potential is you're going to get blamed for the government shutdown. If you're Dick Durbin in Illinois, you're not as worried about what your voters think about that.
Actually, right now, Donald Trump has a 58% disapproval rating in the state of Georgia. Claire McCaskill is doing much better in Missouri because of this kind of thing. And so when you're talking about shutting down the government and any fallout that might have normally happened, because it is being posed in this racially offensive context, people like Claire McCaskill that are in these swing states, if you will, are doing much, much better and will continue to do so.
I've got to take a break, our final break of the show. You know what? When we come back, let's talk a little Georgia politics. We haven't done that yet. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Millions of Americans are walking around with implanted medical devices, artificial hips and knees, cardiac stents, pacemakers, and many others. On the next Fresh Air, medical journalist Jeannie Lenzer says medical devices are approved with far less scrutiny than pharmaceuticals, and some may be causing harm, even deaths. Her new book is The Danger Within Us. Join us.
Fresh Air, today at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. The mayor of Columbus, Teresa Tomlinson, and Republican strategist, insider, all sorts of words we can use for our friend Eric Tannenblatt. Thanks both of you for being here. Eric, yesterday a group of conservative Republicans, many of them in faith-based organizations, said, yep, religious liberty. We're coming back to the legislature. We're going to have another go at it this session, despite the fact that in his final legislative session, it strikes me that having vetoed the bill once, there's no reason in the world why Governor Deal would suddenly say, you know, why not sign this on my way out the door, even if it were to get through the legislature, which is doubtful. Yes?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to move. And I think it's, look, people have very strong views on this issue, on both sides of the issue, and the people that are proponents of this legislation have a right to let their voices be heard. But I think the governor made it clear, the speaker made it clear. I personally think it is a bad idea, and I don't see it going anywhere.
Teresa,
I think it's a lot of grandstanding.
Teresa Tomlinson, yeah. There are an awful lot of people out there. I'm going to start by saying, I am sort of skeptical and dubious about putting everything that people talk about in this state these days through the lens of, can we win Amazon or not? Mm-hmm. But clearly, that's something that there are a great many people down at the Capitol are worried about in terms of sending a message that this is a state that wants to promote this sort of initiative.
Well, sure. There will be an economic and social shunning, if you will, for being so regressive and so backward. I will say there is a particular absurdity and arrogance, really, about believing that you can improve upon the First Amendment. And I would also say there is a weird irony about believing that you can utilize the secular government to use your religion as a weapon to suppress others. And so to all sort of reasonable minds who step back for a minute, and like the Amazons of the world and the people, this is just, again, so offensive, using government and religion as a weapon against certain people. And then people say, well, gee, my faith requires that I suppress other people and oppress other people. But it doesn't have anything to do with race. Oh, my goodness, no. Please know that the segregationists used biblical mandates they believed and direction for their segregationist efforts.
Yeah.
And it was Genesis chapter 9, and they used that to say that the curse of Canaan required that they keep people of color to be the slaves of the slaves, the lowest of all slaves. And that's what segregationists believed. They believed that they were carrying out a divine mandate. And so you have here the same thing repackaged, largely, of course, because of the gay and lesbian issues that we have related to marriage equality, right? That's where this all came about. So don't mistake this. It's just repackaged. It's what we lived through in the 60s. And no, our state should be looking forward, not backward.
And yet, Eric, virtually every major candidate on the Republican side for governor has signed a pledge saying, yeah, we would support a religious liberty bill if it came across our desk after 2019.
Right. Well, they're running in a Republican primary, and they're trying to out-conservative one another. But, you know, let's see what happens in the future.
So it strikes me, and let me get your take on this first. Maybe this is an issue that, as the session moves on, we on our show, our producers and I, should give thought to not spending quite so much time talking about. And here's why. Because this is kind of not probably going anywhere. And perhaps it's the introduction of the bill, which gives some people, like a Josh McCoon running for Secretary of State, something to wave a banner about. But if it's not going anywhere, maybe we ought to put it on the back seat and pretend it's not really there.
Yeah, I mean, I would invite you to do that.
Yeah, Teresa Tomlin doesn't like this idea at all.
It reveals
but
your
you know
character.
What I'm saying, right?
Let me tell you this. This is a huge litmus test. Something like the Religious Liberty Bill reveals your character of a leader. Will you use government as a weapon against your people? And anybody that supports religious liberty, the answer is yes, they will.
So if the bill's not going to pass, the Speaker Ralston has made his position on this clear for several years now. He had his alternative Pastor Protection Act, which was a relatively innocuous way of addressing some aspects, giving pastors, preachers, ministers, rabbis, whatever, an opportunity to speak their minds without fear of reprisal, a legal reprisal. If he doesn't want it, if the governor isn't going to sign it, what's it all mean?
Hate festers in the absence of leadership. I would ask people who are in elected positions to please stand up and tell these few constituents that started as a few, no Moss here. Absolutely.
Okay. I don't agree with your premise that anyone who supports the Religious Liberty Bill, that's what's in their heart. I don't think that that's the motivation of everyone that is supporting it. I think there are some people that do feel that their religious liberties are at threat, and they have every right to express their opinion. Our political leadership then has to decide whether or not they're going to enact the legislation. I think the leadership in the state has said, no, we're not going to advance this. So I don't think you need to just, have a blanket, all of these people are bad because they support the bill, because I don't think that that's their motivation. Many of them have said they just want to pass a similar legislation that matches up with the federal legislation. We could debate the merits of it and how it applies in Georgia, but I don't think
it's a weapon of government, then they don't understand.
Well, perhaps.
And maybe that may be the case.
Yeah, that may be the case.
Well,
that they're...
then let's look at a different bill to see if we can get to the bottom of the feelings in the state capitol about issues like gay and lesbian rights. Mm-hmm. You've got a hate crimes bill introduced by a moderate Republican, Megan Hansen, from up there in Brookhaven. Now, I have to tell you, I think Megan Hansen maybe didn't have a clue what she was walking into when she agreed to support this, to sponsor this legislation, and I could be completely wrong about that, but it's very controversial. And, Teresa, it's a good example of what your argument is. One of the reasons that it has been so hard to pass a hate crimes bill in Georgia, even one which calls for just enhanced penalties, not a separate offense, is that there are many legislators who do not want to give protections to gays and lesbians as a protected class.
Right.
That kind of speaks to the mindset that you think is operating.
Well, and we saw this too with the adoption bill, right? I mean, there were people who wanted to layer on top of that. Here are these kids in desperate need of homes of love, and we have same-sex married couples who would like to adopt them, and people say, oh, no, because if you have that lifestyle, gay, lesbian lifestyle, then we're not going to allow you the joy of being a parent.
So I think we all probably agree, Eric, that there is
the
a strain
leaders...
of very conservative legislators who have very strong and very conservative views on religion.
Yeah. Right, absolutely. But the political leadership on the adoption bill, too, said we want to strip out that offensive language and pass a clean adoption
bill. Okay.
Can I make one just
real
one?
Quick?
What I just enunciated is a conservative point of view, and the word conservatism has somehow been bastardized in this conversation. Government should not be involved in the sexuality of people. And so it's amazing to me that the Republican Party is allowing the promotion or the pandering to policies to enact legislation about religion being used as a
weapon. All right,
I
got to give you the last word on that. So I want one more subject. Eric Tannenblatt, I turn to you on this because you know these matters cold. Casey Cagle has just reported out his fundraising for the most recent reporting period. Just about $7 million.
That is a lot of money.
Staggering.
It really is.
Now, we haven't heard from everybody at this point, to the best of my knowledge. But what does this mean for his campaign? He's apparently got almost $6 million in cash on hand. they can't. He can't raise money. Michael Williams can't raise money. Brian Kemp can't raise money while the legislative session is underway. So the some of the major guys here are frozen in place, and the primary's in May.
Yeah, I mean, Casey's been the lieutenant governor's been the perceived front runner from the beginning, just because his name ID, and I think this just further solidifies that, you know, he is the front runner. And when you put numbers like that on the board, that sends a huge signal to other people that may be sitting on the sidelines. People want to be with the winner. And so right now, I would have to say that, Casey is the front runner.
On the Democratic side, the two Stacys are working, but neither of them have been in positions, the kind of positions of power, lieutenant governor, for example, secretary of state, even in Brian Kemp's case, to be able to come to donors and ask for those big dollars.
Sure.
Are they going to be at a disadvantage? Once we get a candidate in each party, are Democrats going to continue to struggle against the well-funded Republican candidate?
Yeah, I think Eric's correct in that this clearly shows that Casey Cagle is the front runner. And yes, there's going to be a disparity of fundraising. I will say, though, don't forget that Roy Barnes raised $20 million and two-term Governor Perdue raised $5 million and yet walloped him. So money isn't everything. John Ossoff can tell you that story as well. We'll see.
Well, the one thing I'll say about the Roy Barnes-Sonny Perdue race is the difference there is that the demographics in the state had changed dramatically. I mean, you saw it at the federal level. We elected Republicans all over the place. And that was the last, you know, the governor's race, the governorship was the
last. And you were on board? You were Sonny Perdue's chief of staff in that first term. By the way, Eric Tanblatt, do you know who the one reporter was at the local TV stations who actually spent a lot of time covering Sonny Perdue who had never had a chance to become governor? Me.
Really? I think you'd be a great governor, Bill.
No. I'm saying that we took him seriously all the time because that's what the job is about, taking everybody as seriously as possible. All right, we're out of time for today's show. Teresa Tomlinson and Eric Tanblatt, I would love to have you both come back together again because really, to me, one of the most thoughtful conversations we've had in quite some time. So thank you both very much for being here. Tom Faust is in the control room, nodding vigorously about enjoying listening to the two of you. We are back here tomorrow with A Two-Way Street at 2 o'clock. I hope you can join us. It's a show about the life of one of the greatest jazz singers of the 20th century, Billie Holiday. Our guest is Terry Burrell. She is playing Billie Holiday in a one-woman show at Theatrical Outfit in downtown Atlanta. And it takes us through the ups and downs of Billie Holiday's life. You hear some of her great music. We're also joined by one of the great teachers of African-American music at Emory University, Dwight Andrews. So if you can be with us for that Two-Way Street tomorrow, we'd love to have you here at 2 o'clock. And, of course, we're back with another Political Rewind. Remember, at our new time, 2 o'clock on Friday, so we hope you can join us for that as well. Olivia Rheingold, Tom Faust, thanks for the work you did in getting this show together. I'm Bill Nygut. See you tomorrow for Two-Way Street at 2.